Welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Terence Cuneo. His new book is titled Speech and Morality on the Metaethical Implications of Speaking. It has just been published by Oxford University Press. Cuneo is professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont. It's widely accepted that in uttering sentences, we sometimes perform distinctive kinds of acts. We declare, assert, challenge, question, and corroborate by means of speech. Sometimes, we also use speech to perform acts like promising, commanding, judging, pronouncing, and even christening. Yet it seems that in order to perform an act of, say, promising, one must have a certain kind of normative status. At the very least, one must be accountable. Similarly, in order to issue a command, one must, in some sense, have the authority to do so. It seems, then, that the power to perform acts by means of speech depends upon the normative status and standing of speakers. In Speech and Morality, Terence Cuneo appeals to this fact in devising an original and compelling argument for moral realism. He claims that were it not for the existence of moral facts, we would not be able to perform ordinary speech acts, such as promising. As we clearly do perform such acts, there must be moral facts. That's the simple argument that lies at the heart of Cuneo's fascinating book. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Terence Cuneo.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
Doing well, thanks.
Well, that's great. Thank you for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
It's my pleasure.
And thank you, audience, for tuning in to New Books in Philosophy. Today, I'm talking with Terence Cuneo about his new book, Speech and Morality, on the Metaethical Implications of Speaking. In this book, Terence develops what I think is a fascinating argument in favor of moral realism, and the argument's rooted in a compelling account of speech act theory. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that this book draws surprisingly robust philosophical conclusions from what look to me like sort of undeniable premises. That is sometimes thought to be a gold standard in philosophy books. And I think this book really does a real admirable job at meeting that standard. So there's a lot to talk about. But before we get going on the arguments, Terence, let's begin with you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I was born in New York State, New Rochelle, New York. Both my parents grew up in the Bronx. I think for the most part, they were the first generation, both on my mom's side and my dad's side, to go to college. My dad had an advanced degree, was a lawyer. I don't think that either of my parents would describe themselves as particularly philosophical. And I had no real exposure to philosophy at all growing up. What I did know is that I was really, really bored in high school. And I didn't realize that until I got to college. I took my first philosophy class as a sophomore in college. That was with Georgia Warnke. It was a political philosophy class. And for me, it was like love at first sight. I just fell in love with the subject. And I really didn't know anything about the field. I had very little guidance. I just knew I really liked it. And it looked much more interesting to me than going to law school. So I just sort of pursued my gut on this. And I ended up in graduate school. I went to study medieval philosophy, of all things. At a certain point, when my professors took me aside and asked me, hey, do you want a job or not? And I said, well, of course I want. Well, you ought to be doing something else. You ought to be doing something that's marketable. So I actually sort of in a strategic sort of way switched to ethics, which is like I kind of think of it as one of the few strategic decisions I've made in my life. It really wasn't that difficult. I found abstract questions and moral theory really, really interesting. And so that's what I ended up writing my dissertation on. And this book is, and the one that precedes it, The Normative Web, which came out in 2007, is, you know, really just an outgrowth of thinking about these issues and wondering about these issues for some years.
Excellent. Can I just very quickly, so about the transition from medieval to ethics?
Yeah.
Were you working in value theoretic questions in medieval philosophy, or were your interest in medieval philosophy metaphysical or epistemological? Was there any sort of, I guess the question is, was there any overlap between the medieval stuff and the ethics?
Yeah, there was some overlap, but I was, you know, much more interested in doing more metaphysics actually at that point.
Ah.
And in particular, I was thinking about Aquinas quite a bit and working on Aquinas and, you know, working through his commentary on Aristotle's metaphysics, that kind of thing. So yeah, real historical bent. So it did mark a fairly significant shift in my interests.
Excellent. Well, why don't we talk about the book? And I wanted to start because one of the virtues of the book, there are many, is that very early on you give a very succinct articulation of the main thesis of the book, and I'm just going to cite it or quote it. So in your preface, you say, I'm quoting you, "If there were no moral facts, then we would not be able to speak." Now, I remember reading that as I started reading the book. This sentence occurs pretty early in the preface, even. And I said, wow, to myself, that's a really bold claim.
Yeah.
Wow, I mean, amazing. I obviously do speak. So, you know, you run the inference, and you're like, wow, just by speaking, I can know that there are, because I speak, it follows that there are moral facts in some way. So that sounds to me like, and will sound to some of our listeners, no doubt, like a transcendental argument, an argument that proceeds by trying to identify the conditions for the possibility of something that is obviously possible because it's actual. And transcendental arguments have a storied history in the tradition of philosophy. Can you tell us a little bit about that, the form of the argument, or how you understand? I mean, am I right in thinking that it's a transcendental argument or a quasi-transcendental
argument? Yeah, I think at one point of the book, I actually do characterize it as being transcendental in nature. As you characterize transcendental arguments, you know, specifying the necessary conditions of the possibility of some phenomenon that we have really good reason to believe is actual. I think the argument is probably aptly described as a version of a form of a transcendental argument. That having been said, I don't really spend any time in the book talking about transcendental arguments. I know there's a lot of controversy and about exactly how to characterize them and, you know, how they're supposed to work and so forth. So I don't really get into any of that. And as far as I'm concerned, the labels aren't going to matter so much. But as far as capturing the spirit of the argument, the way it's supposed to go, I think it does capture the spirit of the argument and roughly the way it runs without sort of digging into the details of, you know, exactly how different how transcendental arguments are supposed to run.
Right. And am I right in thinking that this kind of argument, however we would like to call it, there's a separate issue, but this kind of argument, I mean, it seems it's not commonly deployed, at least in the meta-ethics that I know of. I mean, this seems like a novel style of argument for moral realism. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, I suppose you're right about that. I hadn't quite thought about that as I was working through the argument and trying to spell it out, but I suppose that's right. I suppose David Enoch's recent 2011 book, Taking Morality Seriously, which is in my opinion a wonderful book,
yes,
comes close to, with his inference of the best explanation, doing something in this area. I think it's fairly unusual, but maybe it has some close relatives in the meta-ethical literature as well.
And one last question on this. The argument that you present is a kind of stronger or more robust, or tries to get a more robust conclusion than an inference to the best explanation argument. The argument that you're pressing isn't that like an infant to the best explanation. You know, that there would, if there were moral facts, it would be a really good explanation of the things that we can see. So therefore we should believe them. This thing that we have good reason to think that we do would be impossible were it not for the facts, right?
Yeah, I think that's right as far as sort of the core argument in the book. Now, as far as arguing for various premises of the argument, yeah, I think we do have some inferences to the best explanation at work.
Right.
For sure.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, good. Let's again, this is I'm fascinated by the argument.
Okay. That's funny. You know, we philosophers work on things, and you work on it long enough, and it just feels utterly pedestrian. You know, when someone finds it interesting, I think, oh yeah, I remember once finding it interesting.
I should forward you some emails between me and a couple of my colleagues here where I've sent them sentences from the book. I'm like, this is an amazing, what an ambition, what an amazing book. By the way, there are probably about six people at Vanderbilt who are reading the book right now.
Nice. Oh, great.
Now let's turn to the sort of central plank of the argument, or one of the main ingredients of this argument, which you call the normative theory of speech.
Yeah.
And this is a particular interpretation of what our listeners will recognize as sort of speech act theory. Can you tell us a little bit about this particular version of speech act theory and maybe contrast it with some of the other positions that our listeners might be familiar with, sort of Searle and Gricean kinds of views?
Yeah, sure. Within the tradition of working in speech act theory that, you know, J.L. Austin and got up and running, and John Searle certainly made really, really important contributions to, and William Alston, these philosophers tend to work with a threefold distinction between what they call locutionary acts, illocutionary acts, and paralocutionary acts. Locutionary acts are just basically acts of uttering or inscribing sentences. So right now, you and I are performing various locutionary acts, or sentential acts, as you might call them. Mm-hmm. Illocutionary acts, by contrast, are what are often referred to as speech acts, such as asserting, commanding, promising, christening, declaring, so forth. The thought is that we perform illocutionary acts by the performance of locutionary acts. So it's by performing sentence utterances or sentence inscriptions, or if you're, you know, speaking with sign language, you know, movements of the hands, that you assert things or promise things or command things. Paralocutionary acts, which is the third category, are acts by which we bring about certain kinds of effects in our audience, such as bewildering them, or puzzling them, or delighting them. And so philosophers have wondered, after they've made these distinctions between three different types of acts that constitute speech, how they all hang together, how are they related? There's agreement that we perform illocutionary acts by the performance of locutionary acts, and that we perform paralocutionary acts by the performance of locutionary acts and illocutionary acts. But, like, how do these things hang together? And the puzzle that I focus on in the book is what exactly the relationship is between locutionary acts, say sentence utterances, and illocutionary acts, say assertions or commands. And the thought is something like, sentence utterances aren't identical with illocutionary acts. When I utter the sentence, say, the coffee is hot, that's not identical with asserting that the coffee is hot, because I can utter that sentence without asserting anything. I might just be offering you, for example, an example of a well-formed English sentence, or maybe testing a microphone. Likewise, I can perform the action of asserting that the coffee is hot without uttering that sentence. I can do it by way of moving my hands in certain ways, or even by Morse code. So the two types of acts are not identical, but they're very, very closely related. And so now we have to figure out what exactly the relation is. What is the glue? How does it come about that our performance of uttering a sentence like "the coffee is hot" counts as asserting that the coffee is hot? So within the Speech Act literature, there are basically two main schools of thought here. On the one hand, there's Grice, and I think under a certain interpretation, Searle, although I think it's a little more difficult to pin Searle's views down here. Definitely William Alston, who has a very important book that he published in 2000, Illocutionary Acts and Sentence Meaning. Also, Robert Brandom defends a view in this neighborhood. And my teacher, former teacher, Nick Walterstorff, interestingly enough, way back in, I think it was 1980 in his book on aesthetics, Works and Worlds of Art, and later in his 1995 book, Divine Discourse, defended what I call the normative theory of speech. So that's one sort of tradition within Speech Act theory. And the other tradition within Speech Act theory, mainly has its roots in Grice's work, is the so-called perlocutionary intention theory. So they're going to offer us different accounts of what brings it about, what explains that the utterance of a sentence counts as, or as I sometimes put it in the book, generates a speech act, or an illocutionary act, such as commanding or asserting or promising. So what the normative theory does is it says, what explains the fact that, say, a sentence utterance generates an assertion is the fact that the speaker, by uttering that sentence, has altered his normative position vis-a-vis his audience. So the thought is, if I utter the sentence, that cup of coffee is hot, and it's false, say that that cup of coffee is hot, you now have a right to correct me. I am liable to correction in uttering that sentence, as I have, as it were, put myself on the hook and made myself liable to correction. Or say a little differently, I utter the sentence and I don't believe it at all. I don't believe that the coffee is hot. Well, now I'm also liable to correction of a certain kind. In this case, you have a right to say admonish me for lying or being insincere or what have you. So the normative theory of speech wants to say, at least in part, what explains how it is that the performance of locutionary acts generates illocutionary acts is, as I say, shift in normative position, which speaker has rights, responsibilities, and obligations of certain kinds. The perlocutionary intention view tends not to pay much attention at all to rights, responsibilities, and obligations, although one of the observations I do make in the book is that I think under a fairly natural construal, it's kind of there below the surface. It's just they're not stressing it. What they tend to emphasize is the speaker's intentions in speaking. The thought is that what brings it about that a sentence utterance counts as an assertion is that the speaker wishes to get his audience in a certain kind of state of mind. What state of mind exactly? Well, they differ about what they say there, but something like an intention to get the audience to believe the proposition just uttered, or at least to consider the proposition just uttered so as to be in a position to consider it, reject it, accept it, or what have you. So, there are different ways of combining these views. One could combine both the views, but for the most part, perhaps a difference in what these different theorists think is fundamental. The normative theorists think that, yeah, it's the normative stuff that's fundamental. It's really doing the explaining here, at least a lot of the important explaining. Whereas the perlocutionary act folks want to say, no, it's the speaker's intentions that are really doing the explanatory work here. So part of what I have to do in the book is to spell out the normative theory in some detail. In a lot of ways, you know, for me, that was the most time-consuming aspect of writing the book because it required me to dig pretty deep into the literature and also try to go some places where the literature hadn't gone. That's the basic difference. And one of the points I do make, as I've already mentioned at various points, is that it takes a little bit of work to formulate a version of the perlocutionary view, which, you know, sort of lets the normative dimensions of speech just kind of slide. It doesn't really care about those things. It doesn't emphasize at all the explanatory work that these features are doing. So I work with a version of the prelocutionary view, which really downplays the normative dimensions of speech, and a version of the normative view that really emphasizes the normative dimensions of speech.
So great. So would you let me return to that sentence that I quoted from the preface, and let me introduce a little tweak to it, and see if you would accept this. So would it be too far off to say that if the thesis is that if there were no moral facts, then there'd be no illocutionary action?
Yeah. So I'm definitely thinking of speech or discourse as consisting in the performance of illocutionary acts or speech acts. Yeah. So an important thing to see here is that speech is a pretty robust phenomenon. The thought is not that it would be impossible for us to communicate information where there are no moral facts. Rather, the thought is we couldn't perform such acts as asserting and promising and commanding and declaring and the like where there are no moral facts. So, yeah.
And just to sort of preview, I'm going to ask you something in a minute to fill in the details. And the reason for that is that in order to be an asserter, well, in order for there to be assertions or challenges or commands, there have to be the normative roles or the normative standings of being an asserter or a commander or a declarer. Is that how the argument runs?
Yes. it gets a little complicated at this point, because I think speech acts have different profiles. So if you were to think about, say, what's required to perform speech acts such as commanding and promising, at least in a non-defective way, you know, perform a well-formed version of these sorts of speech acts. One of the observations I make in the book is that, you have to have a certain kind of standing power, a certain kind of authority to issue the command or issue the promise. I, for example, could not perform a well-formed promise right now to give you a pay raise, whereas your provost could, right? so I have to have a certain kind of standing or authority to do that. And that certainly looks like it's a normative standing. It consists in having certain kinds of rights vis-a-vis a certain class of people. It's worth noting that the normative theory as such doesn't commit itself to this normative stuff, the rights, responsibilities, obligations, the standing powers, or the authority that one has in order to perform these speech acts, is moral, right? That takes argument. It's just right now the point of saying, there's normative stuff here that's got to be in place in order for us to perform these speech acts.
Good. Let me just ask one other sort of, again, sort of prefatory question, because I'm about to ask you just to run us through what you call the speech act argument.
Yeah.
Could you sort of maybe it might be helpful to our listeners, maybe for you to draw the analogy that you begin in the book with, the sort of response from Clark to Hobbes. And I take it that the book is in a sense a kind of, you know, playing out of this critical thought that Samuel Clarke had against Hobbes and sort of trying to generalize it.
Yeah. So the thought is under an interpretation, which I'm not at all convinced is correct of Hobbes, but take a broadly conventionalist approach to morality. I think in the book I actually do quote from Elizabeth Anderson at Michigan, who seems to be sympathetic with the view in this neighborhood. We'll take a view according to which, you know, here we are. We've got to live together. We've got to make arrangements so that we treat each other well and so forth. So what we do is discuss things and, in Hobbes' case, make a compact with one another. So as to institute certain kinds of norms. And it turns out that when we get together and do this sort of thing, this is the way that morality emerges, right? We talk to one another, we discuss things, and we make agreements of various sorts, and bam, there we have it, right? Much in the same way you might think of law. You know, we got together, started talking about what sorts of laws we need in order to have, you know, say, a traffic system that works halfway well or what have you. And they're thinking about morality along similar lines. Now, Clark found himself mystified by this in Hobbes, right? Because I think he was sensitive to the fact that in order for these folks to get together and you know, have these discussions and make promises to one another, the very act of performing promises or compacts with one another looks really normatively loaded to begin with. And when you take a closer look at the normativity involved, it also appears to be moral. So Clark's worry is that, hey, you know, under this interpretation of Hobbes, or at least conventionalist views, they're not explaining the emergence of morality or moral norms at all. In fact, the very speech acts that they perform in order to articulate these norms presuppose the existence of such norms. So that's basically what Clark was worried about, and it's this kind of observation that I try to generalize from and enrich in the book. Yeah.
Well, great. So we've got so far as the fact that there is speaking that's recognizable to us as such means that there's normative stuff.
Yeah.
I guess then the real core is the speech act argument that you raise early in the book and then keep referring to and returning to the defense of.
Yeah.
Can you run us through that more particular argument that's supposed to show that the kind of normativity that gets involved is of a particular sort, and it emerges in a particular way, and then the next link in the argument is going to be, and we need to give a realist interpretation of that stuff. But can you run us through the Speech Act argument first?
Yeah, so the argument is going to begin with the observation that we do perform illocutionary acts such as asserting, promising, commanding, and the like. And there has to be something that explains why the performance of what are called locutionary acts following Alston generates these illocutionary acts. And then the claim is that it's an agent's having the rights, responsibilities, and obligations of being a speaker that does this work. That so far forth, those that second claim and the third claim is basically the normative theory of speech. What I claim then is that some of these rights, responsibilities, and obligations are moral. Since we do speak, there are moral rights, responsibilities, and obligations. I just refer to these as moral facts of certain kinds. That's not exactly right, but it'll work for our purposes.
Yeah.
So then we talked a little bit about this, like an argument to the best explanation, how this sort of argument is much more popular in metaethics. Yeah, here I do offer an argument to the best explanation that when you actually dig into the details of the sorts of rights, responsibilities, and obligations that speakers have when they perform illocutionary acts such as asserting and promising, commanding, they look for all the world as if they are moral features. So, for example, if we're in a situation, once again, and I assert that the cup of coffee is hot, and it really matters, let's say, you know, this is nuts, and yet I dissemble. I give you some false information in a context that matters. I'm trying to think of a context in which this really does matter, but anyway, let's just imagine it really does matter. And I put myself on the hook, you know, if it turns out that, I've uttered this, and I'm not sincere at all in the utterance, dissembling, now I'm liable to blame, to admonishment. And so you might think, what kind of violation has occurred? And I want to claim that, yeah, for all the world, looks like it's a moral violation of a certain kind. You, as the audience, have a right to hold me morally accountable for dissembling in this case. So the thought is that there is going to be lots and lots of normativity in speech. Speech is suffused, I want to say, with normativity. And some of the normativity, some of the rights, responsibilities, and obligations look to be moral. I help myself to a broadly Reedian sort of methodology, according to which, in this case, We ought to trust the appearances unless we've got some pretty good reasons not to. So I don't conclude, and you know, so therefore they are moral. I just say, yeah, we've got some prima facie evidence for thinking they are. Now we've got to consider some views or some reasons for thinking that they couldn't. The normative stuff that Cephus's speech couldn't be moral. So that's an additional step in the argument. And there I engage with some of the more popular arguments against there being moral facts. I make some moves here, I think, that are perhaps different from a lot of the moves that you see in the metaethical literature. One of the moves that I try to make is that I take a claim such as, I think I call it in the book, the normative claim.
Yep.
I say, it looks for all the world that it's morally wrong to break one's promise simply because one feels like it. Okay. Mm-hmm. That seems pretty plausible. Now, take that claim. In fact, I'm going to say that, you know, if you had something like an alleged moral system and it didn't include propositions of this sort, it would be incomplete at best. And if it's sort of issued in its denial, at least for creatures like us, situated as we are, I think we would have a normative system that's not a moral system. This really does look to be constitutive of a moral system. And so... Yeah, I take claims like this that I think have a pretty good claim to being sort of framework status propositions. Under some usages of the claim, conceptual, look to be conceptual truths of a certain kind. And then I take a look at some of the arguments that philosophers offer for moral anti-realism. One really popular argument that stems from Mackey and Joyce in his books. Most obviously in his book, The Myth of Morality, notes that realists are committed to the claim that if moral facts exist, then there must be categorical reasons, reasons that apply to us no matter what sorts of commitments we have, and that there couldn't be any such reasons, so there are no moral facts. So I focus on that first claim. If there are moral facts and there's got to be categorical reasons, just granting for the sake of argument that it is also a sort of a framework status proposition, anything that counts as a moral system would have to imply or include this. And then I say, well, you know, take a look at these two propositions, the normative claim on the one hand, which says it's morally wrong to break one's promise simply because one feels like it. And on the other hand, this sort of metaethical claim that if there are moral facts supposed to be a conceptual truth, then there've got to be categorical reasons. And I say, well, you know what? You know, folks like Mackey and Joyce really haven't given us much reason to reject the first claim rather than the second claim. Right. And as best I can tell, they don't really have any non-arbitrary reason for doing that. And so what I do here is not argue that these views are false, but I do argue that, that is to say, views like the error theory, according to which there are no moral facts. But they're definitely undermotivated. The proponents of these views haven't given us powerful enough arguments to hold that there are no moral facts and that we ought not to say take the appearance that you know, when I dissemble in telling you that the coffee is not hot, that I've thereby violated a moral obligation.
Right, and you present, if I'm remembering correctly, you sort of present this argument or this form of the argument against a couple of different competing views.
Yeah.
And it takes the form of a dilemma, doesn't it? That is that the error theory either has to, and these are what you sometimes call mixed views, and I take it that the mix is that they commit to some kind of normative claim, even if it is just a claim about what a moral system or what a moral theory ought to be like. You say, well, either we can't make the distinction between, say, you know, moral discourse and other kinds of normative discourse, or actually, now, what's on the other side of the dilemma?
Yeah, basically, I said, look, I'm going to take it for granted that something like the – well, I just argued – I'm not going to take it for granted. I just argued for the normative theory of speech. So let's suppose I'm right about that, that this is sort of the best view we've got up and running. Now, what should we say? And I've also argued that we have pretty good reasons to believe that some of this normative stuff is moral. That's It really looks that way. I think on the face of things, an error theorist might be perfectly happy. You know, the error theorist, once again, is someone who says that there are no moral facts. Might be perfectly happy saying, oh yeah, of course there are normative features, rights, responsibilities, and obligations that constitute speech, but it's all non-moral. So we're going to have to reject the claim that the appearances are veridical, right? We have to reject the claim that, the fact that, some of these rights, responsibilities, and obligations appear to be moral, at the end of the day, give us good enough reasons to believe that some of them are moral. So they've got independent reasons for thinking there are no moral facts. And so then I present a dilemma, something like, look, some of your arguments are such that they're so powerful that they would imply that there isn't even this sort of more mundane, conventional sort of normativity, the sort of normativity some would associate with law or etiquette or
baseball.
Or baseball, exactly.
Which is one of the examples.
Yes, right. So, yeah, that part of my autobiography didn't come out, but I did played a lot of baseball growing up. And I even played in college for a year. These views are subject to an arbitrariness problem where they're taking certain kinds of conceptual truths as sort of dispositive, or what appear to be certain conceptual as dispositive, and using them to claim that there couldn't be moral facts. And my claim is, well, hold on. A claim such as the normative claim looks as on the face of it to have just as much claim to being a framework status sort of proposition that anything worth calling a moral system would have to incorporate. As some of these other claims you're making, such as if there were moral facts, there's got to be categorical reasons. And, you know, the argument is that you haven't given us, sufficient reason to jump one way on this matter rather than the other, rejecting, say, the normative claim as opposed to the claim that, if there are moral facts and there are categorical reasons.
Right. So, can you run us through? So, that dilemma then gets pressed also against another kind of denier of moral realism, right? So, we've got the error theory, which says not only are there no moral facts, but morality is in some systematic way deceptive because all of our moral beliefs have to be false and or maybe nonsensical, depending on the error theorist we mean, because they don't refer to anything or there are no facts of the matter.
Yeah.
But there's this other character who's a little bit more slippery, I take it.
Oh, much more slippery.
called the expressivist.
Yeah.
And you run a similar kind of, or you run maybe even run the same dilemma against the expressivist. Can you tell us a little bit about?
Yeah.
Well, if you first tell us what expressivism is, well, maybe that is quite a task in itself.
Yeah. So let me back up just a moment. So one of the observations that I make when I present the argument we're just running over about without hinges on the claim that if there are moral facts, they've got to be categorical reasons you have no matter what. This is pretty much the argument to which error theorists turn. You'll find very, you know, at least writing after Mackey, this is the one they rely really heavily on. So in presenting that argument, working through it, I take it I was trying to engage with the main motivation for accepting the error theory. Expressivists don't really deploy this argument so much. What they like, and I'm going to say just a moment, in a moment, what expressivism is. They like a different argument, which says, hinges on the claim that if any agent judges that, say, she's morally required to act in a certain way, then she must be motivated to some degree to act in that way. So, posing a really tight connection. In fact, they're going to talk about it as being conceptually necessary connection between moral judgment and motivation. So they think this is a datum that any decent meta-ethical theory needs to accommodate. And they press the point against realism that realism struggles to accommodate this datum. So my strategy here is not to say, oh, yeah, realism can accommodate this datum. That's not the sort of strategy I use here. The strategy here is to, once again, posit a certain kind of dilemma. articulating this dilemma does require us to get straight on what exactly expressivism is. And as you say, this is tricky because the view is comes in a number of different varieties and get very slippery. But very roughly speaking, what the expressivist wants to say is that when I judge that it's wrong to perform an action, my judgment doesn't represent any moral property or moral fact, at least as realists are thinking about it, or even error theorists are thinking about them. Rather, what I'm doing is expressing an attitude of disapprobation again towards some element of non-moral reality. So if I say, look, you're stealing that book from the library, that's wrong. An expressivist interpretation of that speech act and the thought which is being expressed by that speech act is something like, yeah, you're expressing disapprobation toward the agent for having performed the action of stealing a book from the library. And it might be because stealings have the property of failing mills, principle of utility or what have you. You can fill in a lot of details as to, you know, why it is that they would express disapprobation or in virtue of what features they're going to express disapprobation of stealing. So this view notes that it is perfectly situated to capture the really tight connection between moral judgment and moral motivation, because it turns out that basically moral judgments just are expressions of motivational states of approbation, disapprobation. Okay, so suppose that's right. Suppose it's conceptually necessary that these moral judgments are intrinsically motivating. And suppose you argue from that claim that we've got good reason to believe that they're no moral facts. I won't spell out the argument here, but I will if you ask me to. But basically, the thought is that if there were moral facts, then it's highly likely that moral judgments would express moral beliefs. But moral beliefs, as realists think of them, couldn't bear this very intimate connection to motivation. So this gives us really good reason to believe there aren't any moral facts. Okay. So what I want to focus on is this claim that moral judgments are intrinsically motivating, which they're presenting as a conceptual truth. And then I return to what I call the normative claim, which is the judgment or the claim that it's morally wrong to break one's promises simply because one feels like it. And then I present a similar sort of dilemma, like, okay, you want to let go of that claim, at least under a certain interpretation, according to which there really are moral properties, and hang on to the claim that moral judgments are intrinsically motivating. What I try to argue through a series of maneuvers is that too doesn't look well motivated, that we have no more reason to go for this claim that moral judgments are intrinsically motivating than the rejection of the claim that it's morally wrong to break one's promises. Now, that's kind of a simplified version of the argument, even though it didn't sound so simple as I tried to talk through it, because there are other moves to be made in it. But yes, it's a very, very similar strategy.
Right. And is the sort of the end game in these arguments, these sort of dilemma arguments, sometimes philosophers talk about playing for a win and playing for a tie. Is the aim here simply to sort of hold off or put at arm's length or stiff arm some of the you don't have to be a moral realist to think that some of these moves against realism have the flavor of being just a little bit too quick, right? So I'm wondering if the strategy here with the dilemma simply to say, well, not so fast to the anti-realist. There's something that the case against realism from the anti-realist has to presuppose that, requires a lot more philosophical work to vindicate than the anti-realists have put up so far.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a flavor to of the arguments of that sort. I think strictly speaking, you could think about the arguments sort of coming in stages. So one stage that we've already engaged in, we've argued for the conclusion that speech is generated by normative features of various kinds. So we've got on the table rights, responsibilities, and obligations. Okay. So I want to say everyone should be on board with that, whether you're a moral anti-realist or not, because we're not yet coming down on whether these things are moral or not. And then we have the second stage of the argument, which goes, well, they sure seem, at least some of them seem to be moral. And, you know, giving a broadly Reedian sort of methodology that in this case, these judgments are issuing from, and I talk a little bit about this and in some other work, I talk more about this, issuing from a sort of epistemic practice that's in good working order. So, you know, this appearance has to be taken very seriously. Now, so that's the second stage. Now we come to the question of, well, do we have good reasons to deny the appearances in this case that say that there's normative stuff, but despite the appearances, none of it's moral. And so, yeah, these arguments that I present against, or objections I present against, expressivism and error theory and the like are supposed to, make the charge that these arguments aren't good enough to sort of discharge I don't want to quite put it that way. These arguments aren't quite good enough for us to believe that we ought to deny the appearances in this instance.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So not showing that they're false, right? But like, it's time to come up with some better arguments.
Right. 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 Let me ask next about another sort of, and again, this is, I'm not sure if this is a controversial thing to say, but the next sort of critic that you take on probably represents what might be the mainstream now in, or at least one of the more formidable views. So the constructivist is somebody else who comes up for a certain kind of critique. And I take it that, I don't work in metaethics, but I take it that this is a pretty mainstream view at this point, and perhaps more than the error theorist or the expressivist are, the constructivist represents a kind of, a really popular view these days.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about how those arguments run?
Yeah, so maybe we should talk just a little bit about the difference between, say, a realist view that I'm sympathetic with and a constructivist view. So,
sure.
So they're going to agree. They're close cousins. At least let me put it this way, that in some very prominent versions, constructivism is a close cousin to realism.
And the constructivist sees as the opponents the same guys that you see as your opponents.
Yes, that's
right.
That's right. Good. So they're agreed on that matter too. So what they're going to, the fundamental disagreement between these theories concerns the nature of moral facts. And what the realists are going to say, at least the realists that I'm concerned with here, and the view I want to try to defend, is that there are certain kinds of fundamental moral facts. You might think of them as a sort of very general moral norms, such as one ought not to engage in recreational slaughter or break promises simply for the sake of saving face or what have you. So some fundamental norms, and that these norms don't hold in virtue of the fact that agents have certain kinds of attitudes or would have certain kinds of attitudes towards non-moral reality. So it's not the case, according to the realists, that it's wrong to engage in recreational slaughter because people happen to disapprove of recreational slaughter, or they would disapprove of recreational slaughter if they were sort of given vivid descriptions of it or something like that. The constructivist disagrees. So the constructivist is going to say, no, at the end of the day, fundamental moral norms or fundamental moral facts are determined by the attitudes of actual or hypothetical agents. So that's the difference. And in a lot of ways, we get closer to the debate between Hobbes and Clark here when we talk about the debate between realists and constructivists. So the basic point I want to make here against constructivism is that, yeah, constructivists can say that not only is speech constituted by normative features, they can also agree that at least some of these normative features are moral. What they're going to do, however, is offer a non-realist understanding or non-realist construal of these normative features. And here I get worried about how the constructivist is going to try to pull this off. The thought is roughly this: when you try to characterize the circumstances under which an agent, you call that agent a constructing agent, right, whose attitudes make it the case that something is wrong or right or what have you. When you try to specify the conditions under which that agent performs those or has attitudes of approval or disapproval towards non-moral reality. It's really difficult to do so in such a way that one can do so without sort of smuggling in into those conditions commitment to moral facts. And in this case, I try to point out that it's really difficult to do so without smuggling in various commitments to claims about speech, which are going to carry with them commitments to moral facts, if what I've argued thus far is correct. So that's just sort of a like what's behind the argument. Take a case in which I falsely promise you to meet you for coffee. Is that wrong? Now, a constructivist of a certain kind is going to say, well, that's wrong just in case an idealized version of myself would disapprove of it. Okay, that's what's going to make it wrong. And I observe that, well, hold on. Let's look at, you know, what it is that the constructing agent, the idealized version of myself, has an attitude towards. It's the performance of a speech act, right? It's moral reality of a certain kind that the agent, if the argument's been right, that's already in the picture and towards which the constructing agent has an attitude. But if that's true, it can't be that constructivists are giving us an account of sort of fundamental moral norms or anything. They're already in the picture. So that's one stage of the argument. It's not the final stage, but at least you can kind of get a flavor for what I'm driving at here. That it's going to be difficult to specify the conditions in such a way that they don't make essential reference to speech and hence moral features.
Yeah, and that again, as an outsider in a lot of these debates, at least as they play out in metaethics, I'm more familiar with the ways that they play out in some of the ways in which political philosophers appeal to constructivist ideas. There does seem to be sort of an old, almost Euthyphro dilemma that's at the problem, right? That I don't, I just don't see how they get around. I don't see how they get around. And I guess what your argument is saying is, like, you could even almost characterize your responses. It's the Euthyphro dilemma.
Yeah.
Well, great. So let me then move on to the final chapter of the book, which takes up in very careful detail, a real mainstream and very influential argument that is due to, I take it mainly to Sharon Street,
right?
Although, you know, it can be found in all kinds of other places, and certain philosophers of mathematics have been using this kind of argument for against mathematical realism for a long time, which is this sort of epistemological worry, right? If there are facts of the sort that the moral realist says there are, if there are items of this kind, there are questions about not only how we could know them or how we could come to grasp them, but now to put the finer point on Street's particular version of this, it would be a remarkable coincidence if our reasoning capacities and cognitive capacities developed evolutionarily in such a way as to help us to grasp them, because the evolutionary pressures seem to point in some other direction. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Is that the challenge?
Yeah.
So can you walk us through this? Again, this is a fascinating, but the book ends on such a fascinating set of considerations. Can you run us through that argument?
Yeah, sure. And basically, you know, before we get to this chapter, and the preceding chapter is really the conclusion of the speech act argument. So, okay. But I kind of saw some low-hanging fruit here, and I thought, oh, well, you know, it looks as if, you know, we can get some explanatory benefits from the argument as well. So the last chapter is assuming that the argument has gone through. So there are no new, as it were, moves being made in that regard. So there's this challenge of how it could be on the assumption that our faculties or capacities for making moral judgment have sort of been really, really heavily influenced by evolutionary forces that, in the case of morality, a pretty good reason to believe aren't, you know, in any interesting sense aimed at truth or forming true beliefs, but simply, you know, getting us around the world. So there are really two main moves that I make in the chapter. And here, I'm trying to draw out some of the interesting implications, theoretical implications of the Speech Act argument. The first move is to talk about and to address a worry that, to my knowledge, really has not received the sort of attention that it needs to receive, and that is, well, how in the world do we grasp these facts in the first place? How do we get them in mind in such a way or to such an extent that we can form predicative thoughts about them and so forth? So my suggestion here is something like it could be that, you know, well, let's just assume that I'm correct to claim that moral facts plays certain kinds of explanatory roles. They're the sort of things that, to use the terminology in the book, count generate speech, where this is a non-causal sort of explanatory relation. Now, it could be that we grasp these facts or get these facts in mind in virtue of the fact that we can use concepts of various kinds that are descriptive concepts. Being the sort of obligation that, and this is to put it very, very roughly, you know, count generates the performance of a promise or what have you. So the basic thought is something like, if you've got facts that play certain kinds of explanatory roles, we can get those facts in mind in virtue of using descriptive concepts that those facts satisfy or those properties satisfy. This is highly controversial, obviously, in philosophy of language, but, you know, it's a live view, and I think it would have to be supplemented beyond what I do here. But at least I try to show, you know, this is an option available to the rest. Once you've got moral facts or moral properties playing certain kinds of explanatory roles, you should be able to grasp them by the way of certain kinds of descriptive concepts. And one of the examples I use in the chapter is to talk about, say, you know, the subatomic realm, right? There, too, it may be that, you know, we're getting things in mind. We're referring to them in virtue of working with certain kinds of descriptions. Strictly speaking, we don't see them. We see effects, and we try to theorize about these things by talking about these entities as being the sort of thing that has, you know, plays such and such explanatory role. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the first move. Okay. Employing the arguments, conclusions, such a way that we can give some sort of account of how we might get these properties and facts in mind. Speculative, controversial, but I think, you know, as I say, worth thinking about, worth working out. Then the second move is to actually engage with Street's worry, which is whether we could have reliable access to these facts, right? Whether we could track these facts, to use her sort of language. Now, as a matter of fact, I think there are a bunch of good responses to Street's argument. But the response I use here is something, it goes along the following lines. Let's just suppose that the Speech Act argument is correct, that in order to speak, it's got to be the case that there are normative features that are ingredient in the generation of speech, that some of these normative features are moral. Now let's add what seems to me a pretty plausible assumption, that it's evolutionarily advantageous for us to be able to speak, to be able to do such things as promise and command and assert. But in order to do that, we've got to be able to sort of keep track of the rights, responsibilities, and obligations that speakers have. We have to engage in this sort of normative scorekeeping, right? Mm-hmm. Holding each other accountable and so on and so forth. That's why it's going to be evolutionarily advantageous. But then I claim, well, we've got the makings of a, you know, pretty interesting response. It actually grants Street quite a bit, or at least this evolutionary debunking argument quite a bit, and says, you know what? It wouldn't be that surprising that evolution had sort of pushed us in the direction of being able to track normative facts, even if they're realistically construed. We need to do so in order to speak. Now, mind you, we might not track them under the description or using moral concepts, or, you know, our ancestors may not have done that. But nevertheless, the claim is we would have been tracking those facts, and then, you know, given reflections, so on and so forth, we'd be able to come to more accurate views about the nature of these facts and so on and so forth, be able to theorize and about them in the way we do. But yeah, that's basically the strategy, trying to capitalize on some of the implications of the Speech Act argument.
Well, excellent. Terrence, you know, you've been very, very generous with your time, and it's been great talking to you about your book, your new book, Speech and Morality on the Meta-Ethical Implications of Speaking. So this is your second book, Defending Moral Realism. What's on the horizon? Where will you go? Where will you go next? Is there a third book?
We better not. Yeah. There are actually two things that I'm, bigger projects I'm working on. One is really off the beaten path as far as sort of contemporary analytic philosophy goes. It's a project in philosophy of religion, talking about the ethical dimensions of ritualized religious activity. As I say, if you know anything about the literature in philosophy of religion, a lot of it has to do with rationality of religious belief and problem of evil and so on and so forth. This is just, as I say, off the beaten path and talking about, what it is to engage in ritual and why it might make sense and why ethically it might be important to do so. So that's something I've been working on quite a bit. The other project, and this is, part three, is a joint authored project. Russ Schaefer-Landau at the University of Wisconsin and John Bengtson at the University of Wisconsin, two really fine philosophers, and I are working on a book manuscript that defends a certain kind of moral non-naturalism. Roughly the view that, there are robust moral facts, and they're not the sort of facts that play any sort of explanatory role or suited to play any sort of explanatory role in the natural sciences. So this view has made something of a comeback. We're going to try to really give it a sophisticated and sympathetic type of development. We're making progress on it. We get a bunch of material, and I think it's going to be, hopefully a really interesting development of the position.
Well, it sounds fascinating. Yeah. And, there's been as an outsider, it does look as if there is a lot of, meta-ethics is the site where a lot of longstanding debates that were more at home in previous generations in other areas of philosophy are now coming home to roost in a way.
Yeah.
So naturalism and non-naturalism, it seems like that it's really in the meta-ethical literature where that argument is being picked up again.
Correct.
Well, that sounds great. And, I'll keep an eye out for that co-authored work. And maybe in the future I'll have the three of on.
talking over one another.
Which sounds like it would be good fun.
Yeah.
But until then, again, thanks a lot for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. And the book is Speech and Morality, Oxford University Press. Terrence Cuneo, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Bob.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Terrence Cuneo of the University of Vermont. We were talking about his new book, Speech and Morality, on the Meta-Ethical Implications of Speaking, newly published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.